Good morning, everybody. It's good to be back here this morning. You know, I said yesterday I really, really love Fellowship of the Spirits. That's a conference that really comes out of my spiritual lineage, and I'm very supportive of it. You know, if you go to Fellowship of the Spirit, you're going to be hearing solution. You're going to be hearing deep experience with the recovery process out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know you're not going to get surprised. It's not about entertainment. It's about a message of depth and weight, and that's really what the Fellowship of the Spirit is about. And I'm glad to be here today. All right, what Carrie and I decided to do yesterday was we decided to make the last two sessions, revolve the last two sessions around the chapter Working with Others. Now, I think as a chapter in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, this particular chapter is criminally overlooked in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. My experience being sponsored in the early days, and if there's anybody that's been around a couple of decades, you'll probably identify with this. But my experience in the early days was there wasn't a specific process for engaging somebody in the steps and helping to get them through the steps of recovery. What there was there was a concerted encouragement to keep you in Alcoholics Anonymous, participating in the Alcoholics Anonymous fellowship stuff. And there was some service, like, you know, please be a coffee maker, please take a commitment. And that's really what was going on in my area. So when I got a sponsor, you know, the sponsor, the first interaction I had with my sponsor and the first instructions my sponsor gave me were these: Chris, I want to see you at a meeting every night until I tell you to stop. That was basically the only instruction I got from my sponsor in my first 3 months. As I started heading towards 6 months, he was starting to suggest that I do a fourth step and a fifth step with him, which was quite good. However, understanding alcoholism the way I do now, there, and understanding the severity of how far down the scale I personally had gone, it's a miracle I stayed sober the first 3 months just going to meetings. You know, I was the type of alcoholic who would need to be detoxed. I was the type of alcoholic who seriously, seriously wanted to separate from alcohol the last 3 or 4 years of my drinking and could not. I was powerless. And when I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was willing to do whatever my sponsor said for me to do, and he told me to go to a meeting every night. This probably saved my life because action, a lot of action, can keep one sober. But I wasn't going to stay sober for long. I needed a recovery experience. You know, In the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, around the time this book was written, a lot of the processes that are in this chapter, Working with Others, were operative. You know, especially in the Akron area. I think less in New York. New York was a little more psychological. Akron was a little more religious. You know, it's still that way. You know, those differences are, they're still that way. But the area that was getting the best results, the area where people were staying sober at a larger percentage, was Akron. And then very soon after that, Cleveland. So what you're reading in this chapter, Working with Others, has a lot to do with what Akron was doing. New York was also doing it, maybe not everything in here, but you know, there was no set in stone procedure when this book was written. They basically took best practices and assembled them. I don't think any specific sponsor was doing every single thing in this book, but the majority of them were doing the majority of this work. Now, I believe alcoholism is an incredibly aggressive illness. It's always more powerful than we give it credit for. When I first was exposed to this chapter working with others, I thought, oh my God, you know, what an overreaction. I mean, if I tried to do this with the people at the beginners meeting, they'd run me out on a rail. We teach people how to share, you know, in the beginners meeting. You know, we're not bringing them over to our house and running them through all this inventory and the first visit, the second visit. You know, a lot of the treatment centers are doing a lot of this stuff. So when I was first exposed to this chapter, I thought that it was an overreaction. I thought that it was maybe a historical, you know, representation of what some of the early alcoholics did. But I also thought this, we do it different in New Jersey now. That's what I thought. Now, as I gained experience with some really, really important teachers in my life, as I gained my own personal experience with the step process that's in this book, I started to see that this chapter is incredibly valuable, incredibly profound. If you're able to utilize the instructions in this chapter working with somebody, you are way increasing their chances of recovering. You know, there's a big difference between encouraging somebody to keep coming and offering them a program of recovery that will give them freedom and power. There's a huge difference. Now, when you bring somebody over to your house, some new guy, and you start working through the instructions in working with others, are you going to lose some people? Absolutely. There's some people that are going to see this as an overreaction and head the other way. And you know what? That's exactly what they should do. You are going to lose the people that you should lose if you're working this process in this book. Our time is incredibly valuable. It will say this in this chapter. Our time is incredibly valuable, and we should not be wasting it on people who will not work with us, who will not follow the directions in this book. We shouldn't waste our time. My first experience as a sponsor was I wanted people to like me, and I didn't want to push them away. I really thought that, you know, I don't want to make a mistake and push them away from AA. You know, that's not my perspective anymore. You know, I don't purposely piss people off so they leave. Don't get me wrong. I'm very compassionate and very inclusive, and you know, please come to my home group. But if you're specifically asking to work with me, there's going to be a different approach. I'm going to do what is in this book, and you know, one out of five people will hang around for that. Four out of five will think that Chris is overreacting, and there's a guy that wants me to be the cookie guy at the meeting. I'm going with the cookie guy. You know what I'm saying? And that's fine. He should be with the cookie guy. I usually get the people who are powerless over alcohol, or else you're not going to be doing this with me. You know, we don't do this stuff from a place of virtue. We do this from a place of desperation. We don't approach this work to be a better AA member. That will never work. There's not enough horsepower in that to get you through this. The only horsepower available to get you through these steps is desperation, is a true understanding that alcoholism is going to take you out. It's only a matter of time unless you get some spiritual defense against alcoholism and a recovery experience. So I'm all for a renaissance in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, going back to these basics, back to the chapter working with others. Now, again, one of the things that I see Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole that they've been very interested in since the 50s is increasing the people in the fellowship, making the doors so wide open that anybody and everybody can get in here. And that is not a bad idea. That is not a bad idea. I would rather have five people that shouldn't be in here and one that is, that should. I'd rather have those six people than to miss the one guy that really belongs here. So the doors really, really need to be wide open. But the emphasis on the pamphlets and the service structure and everything, it's not about recovery. It's about fellowship. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous today is focusing on. They want quantity over quality. It's apparent in everything that gets written out of New York today. Now, I'm a bit different. I would rather have quality than quantity when it's the guys I'm working with. Sometime in the late 90s, I was sponsoring over 50 guys at one time. And I was allowing them to have a lot of say in how I was sponsoring them. I don't do that anymore. I mean, I've really started to pay attention to this particular chapter. And this particular chapter is really how we move people through the steps. But how I used to sponsor was, if you didn't call me up with problems, I left you alone. You know, if you didn't want to do a four step, I let you wait. There was a lot of latitude. I was more interested in quantity than I was in quality. Today, the people that work with me and the people that get through this work, they are on fire. They are card-carrying AA members in good standing. They're working with other people. They're taking commitments that, you know, their life is blossoming in every single aspect. You know, they're getting better jobs. They're a better family member. They're a better friend. They don't have enough time in the day. I mean, that's what happens to the people that work with me and get through this stuff. But not everybody makes it through. That's okay with me today. I'm not attached to whether you like me or whether you're on my sponsorship, schedule. He's mine. You know, I don't care about any of that anymore. I really don't. All I care about is laying the kit of spiritual tools at your feet and helping you to pick them up and to utilize them in your life. That's my job. I'm not here to raise you up. You know what I mean? I'm not here to be your father. I'm not here. You know, sometimes I become friends, especially the people that go through the steps. We become lifelong friends. No doubt about it. But I don't have any, after they get through the steps, I don't claim authority over them anymore. They're not mine. You know, I don't call them up and tell them which shoe to tie first. I don't have the time for that. I'm moving on, and I'm making myself available for the next sick and suffering alcoholic that needs to find a recovery program. And, you know, I've learned all this stuff by paying closer attention to the literature. I don't come out of a fellowship or a group where this is common. You know, this is uncommon to use this book as a sponsorship tool. But I'll tell you what, I've tried it both ways. I've tried to be your friend. I've tried to be your mentor. I've tried to be your teacher. But when I tried getting you through the steps, that's when I saw unbelievably powerful results. A lot of the other stuff, I don't know. Most of the people who didn't get through the steps that I worked with, they're gone. All of the people who got through the steps, I know where they are. We're still connected. We're still connected, and they're living a sober, recovered life, and there's really good things going on. Every single person that went through these steps, I know where they are. The people who didn't, for the most part, probably 90% of them, I don't know where they are. I don't know where they are. Maybe they weren't, you know, hopeless alcoholics. Maybe they didn't need a vital spiritual experience to be able to move through their life. And that's fine too. But again, our time is incredibly valuable as recovered alcoholics. We can help other people optionally, but what this book is basically saying is when it's incumbent upon us to work with somebody, it's with the people who are willing to go through this process. And, we're going to be going through a little bit of this chapter, and I'm hoping that the chapter will back up basically my summation here this morning on sponsorship and step work.
Hi, I'm Carrie, I'm an alcoholic. Well, it's funny because I've been working with women for, since I was 2 years sober, since I had an experience with the 12 steps out of the big book. And I'm a tough sponsor. I don't shoot you bail. I don't listen to drama. And we do the work out of the book very clearly. One of the things that I think has atrophied in Alcoholics Anonymous is qualifying an alcoholic. You know, sitting down and talking with somebody and asking them those questions, the first step questions, before we even start this process. You know, because here's the thing. As Chris was saying, yes, the doors are really wide. And I'm a little bit, again, I'm in a different place of spiritual development than Chris because, I'm only 18 years sober. So I'm a little bit more fundamental with that one where, like, I like the wide doors, but it's my job to weed you out. And that's kind of how I look at it. You know, it's my job. It's my sponsee's job. It's my sponsee's job. It's the women who have been recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body to come in and talk to the newcomer and talk about why they're here, ask them some questions about their drinking, and find out whether or not they're alcoholics. You know, and if they're not alcoholics, send them to the appropriate fellowship that is for them. I mean, I've brought a handful of women through the work who discovered that they were not alcoholics, that they were drug addicts, that they never put alcohol in their body. They did not drink. They did heroin. I was like, great. There's this thing called CA. They use the big book. Here we go. Let's get you to the right fellowship. I'm not about not helping people. I'm happy to bring anybody through the work. I've brought people through the work who are alcoholics. I've brought people through the work who are Al-Anons. I brought people through the work who are drug addicts. I've brought people through the work who are OA. In fact, in New Jersey, you know, I was one of the few women who had experience with the fourth step, and the fifth step, and amends, and actually, you know, worked the book. So when OA had this renaissance with the big book, they would invite me in to do steps 3 through 12 because they didn't have anybody who had any experience with it. So when they would do their big book studies, I was the token alcoholic who got invited in to do these studies. Now there are women in OA who have that experience who can bring people through the work in that way. But in New Jersey, there wasn't that. So they had to invite an alcoholic in. And they were like, don't touch the first step. I was like, no problem. Everything else, let's get going. You know, so when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I told you that at the very beginning, I started on Friday and I said, this is why I am the way that I am, because I died in Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years, and I literally was dead in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I died. Heart stopped. Dead. Not really sure where I went, but I was gone for a little bit. You know, and I died here. And I spent years drinking and dying. And then I spent 2 years abstinent. 2 years abstinent with no God and no steps, no nothing. White knuckling it. And I was plotting my suicide again. And I was planning my drink. And I was deciding what I was going to do. And I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with my daughter, who was a year old. And would my, you know, I'm saying, well, you know, my parents are wonderful people. Maybe they'll take her. You know, my boyfriend who became my husband, I'm like, well, you know, I'm sure he'll be able to help. And I'm writing out my will. And my sponsor calls me up and was like, you know, do you want to go to this meeting? Whether, you know, the big book people that we hate out in Staten Island. He's like, let's go to this meeting. You know, like, this guy from California is going to be there. And, like, I heard he's a pompous jerk and he's going to study with the Dalai Lama. So let's go there and heckle him and hate them and judge the crap out of them and then discuss how much they suck. I was like, I'm all for that because I'm miserable. I'm writing out my will. I'm planning my suicide. I know that I'm going to drink again. I know that that means I'm going to die. And I'm having this process in which I'm letting go of my life at 20 years old and planning on how I'm going to, you know, jettison all of this worldly stuff. But I'm going to go to a big book meeting and hate on this guy who's going to study with the Dalai Lama. Right. Thank God I did, because I got there. And he was talking about amends, and he said, you know, things like all and stuff like that. And I was like, I take exception to the all, you know. How dare you tell me to make amends to those people? Don't you know what they did to me? And he got that smile. You know that smile that people get, like, when somebody comes up to you and, like, how dare you tell me to do this? I'm not writing a four-step. It's them! You know, and you're just like, I have you. You're mine. You're mine! And he gets that smile. And, like, mind you, this guy, if Captain Kangaroo and David Crosby had sex and had a love child, this is what this man looked like. Okay, so Captain Kangaroo and David Crosby's love child is, you know, is he does, though. If you've ever met the man, he really did look like that. You know, and I'm a 20-year-old snot-nosed punk rock brat from New Jersey, and I'm yelling at this guy, telling him, how dare you tell me this? And he just smiles, and he goes, come here. Okay, I'm going to ask you some questions. What happens when you drink? I don't know. Do you have another drink? Yeah. What happens when you have that other drink? Another one. What happens after that? Another one. It's like, well, what happens when you're not drinking? I think about drinking. Are you okay when you're not drinking? Do you feel good? No. I feel like shit. He's like, are you irritable, restless, and discontent? So what, you got this stuff going on in your life, and how are your personal relationships? They suck. I was just, you know, like writing my will, trying to contemplating suicide. you full of fear? Uh-huh. They call me Shaky Carrie because I spill coffee on myself because I'm so trapped in my head that I shake because the waves of thoughts and the brainstorm just express themselves physically. You know, I hide at candlelight meetings at night so I don't have to look at people. And he's like, so how's that working out for you? Not very good. What? Come here. This person's going to read this book with you. Just read this book. And that's how I got introduced to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Joe Hawk accidentally 12-stepped me. You know, how cool is that? But here's the thing, is he qualified me. I didn't know that's what he was doing. I had no idea. He was just having a conversation with me. After he qualified me, he called somebody over and said, hey, you're going to work with her. And that's how I got a sponsor and how I started working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and those are things that, you know, we as alcoholics, you know, recovered alcoholics need to do. You know, because Chris is right. Not everybody who ends up in this room is an alcoholic. No, you know, not everybody who ends up in this room needs to work the program the way that I need to work the program. I'm a hopeless alcoholic, meaning that human power cannot come between me and the bottle. Because of that, I have to work the steps like a drowning man. And that means that I have to follow to the letter of the law the things that are in this book. I told you, we can always add, but we don't ever take away. So when the book tells me I have to say this, do this, write that, that's what I have to do. And this chapter is incredible. If you read, I had like this epiphany, and I'm sure everybody else knew this but me, but I think that I'm original and very, very smart, and I think that like I have like this big book, you know, like I'm a big book investigator. And I remember after worked the steps for a handful of years, I was going through working with others with a sponsee, because I sit down and I read this chapter with my sponsees. I read the lost chapters too. You know, to the wives and the family afterward, because those are the practicing the principles chapters that nobody ever reads, and that people want to know, well, how do I not be codependent? How do I not do these things? I'm like, well, we have chapters on that. You might want to read them. Let's read them. So, like, when I say I do 161, you know, from the title page to 164, that's exactly what I do. I'm a very literal, literal lady. But here's the deal. When I was reading this chapter with a sponsee, I had this epiphany. I said, you know, wait a minute. In working with others, it tells us, you know, when we're having this conversation, we share our personal experience. And so first we talk about the physical allergy, right? And then we share our experience with the mental obsession. And we share our experience with the ism of alcoholism, right? We're sharing our experience in that first conversation with the alcoholic. And then I was like, wow, that's exactly how the first five chapters of the book are structured. Physical allergy, mental obsession, spiritual malady. Oh shit, you mean this book is a 12-step call in print? Well, I didn't know that. Apparently I wasn't that bright. but that's exactly it. And it's so funny when you think about it. It's like, you know, so when you just sit down and you read this book with somebody and you start on the title page and you read to 164, you cover just about everything that's in this chapter. And it's really cool that it's laid out like that, so you really don't have to think all that much about it. You know? But this chapter, in terms of, you know, there's that thing, that instinct that you develop as a sponsor, an instinct that you develop as somebody who is in the 12th step and works here, and I've said this again, and it's probably one of the most profound things that was taught to me, which was that my first step was somebody else's 12 step. My 12 step is somebody else's first step. So when my hand is out there and I'm in the trenches, I'm forever in a first step. I can never step away from it because I'm constantly in somebody else's first step. And when I'm holding up that mirror of the first step and alcoholism and three parts of what it means to be an alcoholic to somebody else, I'm forever asking myself the very same questions. So I can never lose conscious contact with that, why am I here? Because if I'm in the 12th step, I'm forever in the first step. It's like a snake swallowing its tail. It never ends. But here's something that's also really incredible that was taught to me, which is personal recovery depends on AA unity, but AA unity depends on our personal recovery. And again, that's another reciprocal relationship. That when I bring this, when I don't have a message of death and weight, when I bring a sick and demented, untreated alcoholic spirit to AA, what I'm doing when I'm doing this is I'm bringing and inflicting my sickness on Alcoholics Anonymous. When I bring a recovered spirit to Alcoholics Anonymous, what I'm doing is being a service to and a part of the process of Alcoholics Anonymous. So as much as, and I love this because I get invited, because I've been in the service structure for years now, and I've served on multiple things, and I'm all about the 36 principles. I'm all about the circle and the triangle. And I really do check in with it on a regular basis and say, where am I in that in my life? So I do a lot of talks on service structure. So, and I love when they invite me in to do a talk on service structure, and I start talking about personal recovery, and they're like, whoa. You know, this is a service event. And I said, yes, it is. Personal recovery depends on AA unity, and AA unity depends on personal recovery. So if you're a sick, demented fuck, you need to have experience with the steps. Excuse my French. Because guess what? There's something called a bleeding deacon. I can't apply the traditions and concepts to my life until I have that spiritual experience. Until I have that, until I've had the spiritual experience that has been necessary for me to recover from alcoholism, the traditions and concepts don't make any sense to me because they're the extrapolation of the principles that we found in the 12 steps. You understand what I'm saying? They're Russian nesting dolls. So I can't possibly apply the traditions to my home group or even my life, which is really fun, putting traditions in our relationships. I can't do that until I can apply the principles of the steps to my life. Because I have no experience, I have no frame of reference, and I have no schema to place them in. These are all spiritual exercises because we build spiritual muscles. We build the spiritual muscles and we flex those muscles. I can't. Who here goes to the gym on a regular basis like myself and is a gym rat? Okay. When you started out, did you start bench pressing like 300 pounds, right? We started with like, I remember my trainer was like, here, let's we're not even going to put any weights on this bar. This bar is 40 pounds enough, right? So like, let's just start with the 40 pound bar because you look like you're a weakling. You know, he was a Marine, so he was mean. But but he definitely got me in great shape. He ran my butt. But the point is that he gave me the bar first, right? He didn't put any weight on it. He said, work with this first. Build the muscle. Once you can do a certain amount of reps with this, we're going to add some weight. Once you can do those reps, then we'll add some more weight. And then we'll start doing this, and then we'll start pyramiding. And all of a sudden, I'm doing like mountain climbers, and I'm standing on my head, and I'm like, how did that happen? Because I built the muscle. So the personal experience with the 12 steps is absolutely necessary for me to carry a message of depth and weight. So we spent the entire weekend talking to you about where you are in the 12 steps. Where are you? What agnosticisms do you have? What pockets of agnosticism do you have? What amends are unmade? Where are you with 10 and 11? Where are you with spot check? Where are you with pause? Where are you with ask? Where are you with turn? Where are you with discuss? Where are you with your nightly review? Where are you with morning meditation? Where are you with all of this stuff? Because there's no point to having the conversation we're having this morning unless you're good everywhere else. Because there's this amazing thing, and again, the big book knows hide shit from me. Look at that. It says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result, not a result, the result. The entire intent of everything that's in this book up until this point is to have that spiritual awakening. That is the result. That is what we're working towards. Nothing else. Everything else is gravy. It's ancillary. Then what do we do once we've had that? Well, that's what this chapter is all about, is what do we do now that we're here? We've done all of this stuff. We're armed with the facts about ourselves. We're at perfect peace and ease, right? We're not afraid of the past. We're not wishing to shut the door on it. We're placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We're doing prayer and meditation. We're in a place where we've had this awakening. Now, how do we transmit this? And that's the thing, is that this is why the 12 steps, and not why the big book is so damn important. I'm not going to tell you that if you read the step book and did something with it that you didn't have some kind of spiritual experience. You probably did. You know, you can go to like an ashram and have a total spiritual experience. I mean, that's the point of them too. You know, you could do all kinds of stuff and have spiritual experiences. That's great. Can you transmit it? I've met plenty of people, like where I live in Pennsylvania. I mean, there's not a whole lot of women who do big book recovery, which just means like I sponsor like anybody who does any kind of step work, you know, like I'm their sponsor or their grand sponsor or their grand sponsor. I'm known as the bitch to my face. To my face. They're like, they call you the bitch, but you're nice. I'm like, I know, but that's okay. There are people out where I live who, you know, the women really don't do any kind of work at all, except for the women that work with me and my sponsor and blah, blah, blah. But the guys, they're like some of these old-timer guys. And they're out of New York. You know, they might have worked the steps like 40 years ago, you know, and they're really cool, you know. And they do some kind of step thing, like something. Like you'll talk to them and you'll hear stuff and you're kind of like, I'm getting you, then you lost me. You know, when you're listening to somebody, you're like, okay, what? Huh? Uh-oh. But they sound kind of good, and they're sober 40-something years, and they're not, like, hacking up people and burying them in their backyard or anything like that. Like, they seem like pretty normal guys. But the people they sponsor, like, are completely insane. Completely. And they say craziness, and they're in the meetings and they're talking about complete insanity and like say stuff like, well, you don't really need to be an alcoholic to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm like, oh my God, my head just exploded. You know? So, because the thing is these guys with the 40, 50 years may have had a spiritual experience. They probably had something transmitted from their sponsor, but they didn't get a delineated direction. They didn't get, when you do this, this happens, then you need to do this, then you need to do this, the clear-cut directions, the instructions, the recipe for spiritual experience. They got some sort of word-of-mouth transmitted thing. The problem with that is it's very difficult to transmit some ephemeral experience that you had 40 years ago without a clear-cut process. So these guys had this experience 40 years ago, and they're half senile. They've forgotten most of it, and so they throw out stuff, you know, like one-liners, you know, and their sponsees walk around throwing out the one-liners, and so like they're all like throwing out the same one-liners, and meanwhile, like, you know, I don't know, like their people are like, we have rules, like you have to leave your gun in your car when you come to our meetings. Like, you know, like when you're attending meetings where people feel that they need to carry weapons into the meeting, you know that there's something going on up there. And look, it's not the bears, okay? You know, like everyone's like, well, you live in Pennsylvania, like maybe there's wolves. No. These people are just full of fear and need to carry weapons with them to protect themselves from what, I don't know, the trees, bunnies, not sure. But you see my point here, is I'm not denigrating the spiritual experience that these old-timers had. But what I'm saying to you is that we need to have a message and we need to have a spiritual experience and be able to transmit this. And it needs to be predictable. You know, I've been all over the world. I mean, one of the coolest things about me is like people invite me places to speak, which is bizarre because nobody ever wanted me anywhere. Like people were happy when I left. They were like, dude, I thank God she's gone. I'm sure you'll be doing that in a couple hours. But the idea is like, by being me, like I get invited to all over Europe. I was Australia. I'm like, it's like awesome. All over the United States. Like, I'm this little, like, you know, punk rock chick from New Jersey who grew up and became a soccer mom. And all of a sudden, like, I'm like speaking all over the world and people want to know what I have to say about God, which seems utterly bizarre to me, but whatever. Rock on, God. Right. But the idea is that I go all over the world and if I walk into a McDonald's, like, I know what I'm going to get. I walk into a Ruby Tuesdays, I know what I'm going to get. It's predictable, right? And I don't want to call the big book the McDonald's or Ruby Tuesdays of spiritual experiences, but kind of is. It's a, you know, it's a cause and effect. We do this, we get that. You do this, you get that. Each step takes the next step, takes the next step, takes the next step, until you're at this place where all of the steps are working together at once. And that's step 12. You want
to? All right, so chapter 7 is on page 89. Chapter 7, working with others. There's a great promise that starts off right away. And if you are alcoholic, if you are powerless over alcohol, this is an incredible promise. It says, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. I don't know about anybody else, but immunity from alcohol is probably a good thing if you're an alcoholic. And that's a promise. You will ensure immunity from alcohol through intensive work with other alcoholics. Yet we still see a lot of people in AA year after year after year not sponsoring, not taking commitments, not working with other people. Again, this is another reason why I think this chapter is so important. Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. Step 12 is part of the path that you have to thoroughly follow. I think it was essential for me to pass this message on. If you really want to learn something, teach it. You will really learn something when all of a sudden now you're teaching it. I got to tell you. This works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. And I believe this is true. I'll tell a quick story. I signed myself into treatment in April of 1989, March of 1989. And they would put, this was a terrible rehab, by the way. It was absolutely horrid. Now that I know, you know, good treatment processes, and there are good treatment processes, and there are good treatment professionals out there, I make use of what they have to offer. Once a week, I'm sending somebody to a recovery center or a treatment center or a detox. You know, so I make use of what the good professionals have to offer. But this place that I signed myself into, I got a 1.5-hour meeting with my counselor in 28 days. That's it. That should be malpractice. You should be put in jail for something like that, because the therapeutic alliance is the single most important characteristic of treatment. And the therapeutic alliance is, how well have you gotten along with your counselor? How well have you identified? Are you willing to respect them enough to maybe follow some of their suggestions? That's incredibly important. So for me to have had a half an hour meeting with my counselor, it was terrible. But here was, they put me in a lot of groups. And I remember being in this one group, and there was an alcoholic counselor that would run a group. And I would just look at him, because I knew when he was looking at me, he could see right through me. You know what I mean? I knew that I couldn't put anything past this guy. I was always very honest with him, just because I knew he knew. You know what I mean? I can't even describe it. I knew that this guy understood. And then there was somebody in there that wasn't an alcoholic. This woman identified herself as an adult child of an alcoholic. I had no idea what that even was in 1989. I now understand. But I'm thinking, every single time she started to talk, she said, I'm so-and-so, I'm an adult child of an alcoholic. And I would think, you know, I'm Chris, I'm an adult psychotic from a librarian. But, you know, I don't start off every sentence with that. You know what I mean? What is she talking about? You know, so... But anyway, I remember this one day I was on some tirade, you know, it was my turn to share, you know, some sharing, some, you know, garbage is just coming out of my mouth, like this. And she goes, Chris, hold on, stop for a second. She goes, let me ask you a question. And I'm like, what? And she goes, tell me, are you happy, mad, sad, or glad?
Oh, God.
And I'm like, what? I mean, listen, I'm an alcoholic in the middle of detoxing. You know, emotionally, you take every negative emotion, you put them in a blender, and you push the 10 button. And that was about what I was. Happy, mad, sad, or glad. I wanted to kill her after she asked me that. You know, if she was an alcoholic, she would never have been stupid enough to ask me that. You know what I mean? So I knew the difference between somebody who could relate to me, like this alcoholic counselor, and somebody who couldn't, the happy, mad, sad, glad lady. And I'll tell you what, if you would have asked me, who am I going to trust, who am I going to listen to, it's the guy that I know he understands. So we can help where other people can't. One of the things that I deal with all the time is when I'm taking somebody through the steps and they're getting better, you know, their wife is usually pissed off because, you know, all of a sudden he's spending 1 week with this Chris guy and he's starting to get better and I've been working on him for 10 years, you know. I mean, sorry about that, you know. We can help where other people, they may have great intentions, they may have great skill sets, but there's something, you know. Carrie was talking about alcoholics being in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a primary purpose there. There's a singleness of purpose. There is that identification that happens with an alcoholic to an alcoholic. You know, I've also taken some people through the steps who were opiate addicted. You know, and sometimes they make it through. A lot of times what happens is they get to a really strategic step and, you know, they just can't go over that hump. And I think it has a lot to do with they're looking at me and they're thinking, maybe I don't think this guy really understands, you know. So I have better results with somebody who has the same problem I have. I can work the 12 step better with somebody I can work the first step with and identify with, if that makes any sense. Here's some promises. There's always promises in action steps. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. Now, frequent contact with newcomers is a bright spot in my life. I spend a lot of time with it. But I got to tell you, prior to having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, frequent contact with newcomers was not the high spot of my life. I avoided meetings, you know, where people were just going to share a bunch of crap. You know, I mean, oh my God, I was involved in a lot of groups near a VA hospital. So a lot of the VA guys would come in and I'd be like, oh my God, listen to these people. I'm out of here, you know. I need to go to a better meeting. And you know, today it's a different perspective. I don't go to get. I don't go to AA to fill up my spiritual gas tank, you know. I don't think you can do that. I think you need to go to give. I think you know, you've experienced the spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. You need to pass that on. It becomes incumbent upon you. You can't hold on to this gift and keep it to yourself. It's almost impossible to do that once you've had a spiritual awakening. If you do that, if you do say, ooh, I'm glad I got mine, see you chumps later, I can guarantee that that's bad luck. And what will happen is, you know, you're going to lose everything that you gained going through the steps. It's going to slowly, it's slowly going to corrode and erode. And you're going to be back to where you were, a selfish, self-involved, self-centered moron. So, let's see what else it says here. Okay, where are you going to find these people? Remember, this book was written and they were expecting that you were going to need to go out and search out alcoholics. And they're going to give some instructions in where you can find these alcoholics. Remember, there was only two groups of drunks at the time this book was written. Today, you cannot shake a stick without hitting a group of still sick and suffering alcoholics. Where do you think you can find them?
Open, disgusting meetings.
Closed-minded discussion meetings is a really good place. That's a really good place. You know, look, any AA meeting is got them, you know? Just, you know, that's a good place to start. Do I still, you know, go to treatment centers and stuff like that? I've had commitments at treatment centers and rehabs and hospitals and places like that for, you know, since my first year, since like, you know, 1990. I've been doing commitments. And that's a good place. But I'll tell you what, where I have the most success is at meetings. You know, people do show up at meetings today. Also, another place is getting my name out there to people as someone who is willing to help and really willing to help. In other words, you know, I'm not making money on it. What I'm doing is I get calls 3 times a week from families that need to place their kids somewhere. I mean, that happens 3 times a week. And it's because I've pushed my name out there. A lot of times it's not the right time to do a 12-step call on somebody. We favor hospitalization for the befogged, and a lot of these individuals are befogged and need to be medically detoxed or at least medically supervised for a period of time. So a lot of times my first move is to get them into medically supervised treatment. My second move is to make sure the minute they're released that there's a contact or somebody who's experienced with the steps that are going to be all over them. Because what happens is we have become so dependent on these detoxes and these treatment centers. We think the 12-step work is just driving them to the door and getting them through admission. That's medical intervention. That's not a 12-step call. Where the 12-step starts is when you get these people after their medical intervention, you get them after their treatment episode, and you get a hold of them and you start taking them through the steps. You know, some of the places that I'm really preferring these days to send people to are recovery centers. Recovery centers are different than treatment centers. Recovery centers, they really try to get you through the steps while you're in their walls. And sometimes they're successful at that and sometimes they aren't. But if somebody's just an alcoholic or just a drug addict, that's where I try to send them. If there's stuff that needs a lot of clinical attention, I'll make sure that there's a good clinical component in the treatment center. But again, I want to get back to what we're talking about. We're talking about the 12-step. That starts when we pick them up from the treatment center. We expose them to our home group. We make ourselves available to take them through the steps. We help them identify, because a lot of times a treatment center doesn't know what an alcoholic is. Mm-hmm. They put the heavy drinkers and the alcoholics in the same room because they only got one program and they only got one bus. You know, everybody's a paying customer. What we need to do is we need to help them identify, like Carrie was talking about before, we need to help them identify what is an alcoholic, what does powerlessness look like, how much trouble are you in, and hey, guess what? The good news is I'm available and I'll help you with this. It will actually help me to help you with this stuff. So I'm not going to talk too much about where you're going to find them, but on page 90 it says, if there's any indication that the individual wants to stop, have a good talk with the person most interested in him, usually his wife. I a lot of times do this because the family is coming to me first anyway. You know, if I see somebody in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, they're already interested in one way or another. Even if they're being pushed in there by the judge, they're at least coming voluntarily. That's different. If this is a cold call, Chris, can you please help so-and-so? I will. I'll try to find out what have they been using? How much have they been drinking? How old are they? You know, are they in trouble with the law? You know, where are they living? How codependent are their parents? You know, I'll try to learn a whole lot of stuff because I'm gonna have to sell somebody on a recovery process. And it's, don't get me wrong, this is a lot of times a sales job. And you need to get good at it. You can't just say, well, you know, call me if you need me. That's really not the right way to approach this, because they don't know what they need. They don't even know what they're, how much trouble they're in, you know. So at least offer them the dignity of an explanation of what the heck is going on in their lives, you know. You know, rather than just throw your phone number at them because you know they're never going to call you. You know, that happens a lot these days. Get an idea of his behavior, his problems, his background, the seriousness of his condition, and his religious leanings. You'll need this information to put yourself in his place to see how you would like him to approach you if the tables were turned. Now, think about this. This is what they would call in the treatment industry client-driven. What I mean by that is, you don't want to be a cookie-cutter guy. You don't want to have your spiel that you hit the 16-year-olds all the way up to the 80-year-olds. You need to be able to adapt your pitch or adapt your approach so that it will be more conducive to the individual listening to you. You know, you don't want to come off as an evangelizer. You don't want to come off as an idiot. You want them hopefully to be able to identify with you. So remember, this is a sales pitch. Think about if you're selling something. You want to understand who you're selling it to and try to relate to them. Same thing here. You want to understand who you're talking to, and you're going to try to relate to them. Sometimes it's wise to wait till he goes on a binge, and you know, I love making my 12-step call after the crap has hit the fan. That is the best time. Right after they've experienced pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, because they got one more DUI summons in their pocket. You know, they're looking at another 6 months in prison, or they're getting thrown out of the house or whatever. That's when a lot of times they're desperate, and desperation can open one's mind. Think about this. Think about your own experience. Could a Komatsu tractor have pulled you away from your last drink before you had it? I don't know about anybody else, but nobody was going to be talking me into not drinking. That, stay away from that. I exclude you from my life for the rest of your life when that topic even comes up. You know what I mean? So we need to get them. We need to get them when they're susceptible. We need to get them when they're desperate. We need to get them after they've gone on one more binge, after promising everybody they're done. They've had one more DUI, whatever. If he does not want to see you, never force yourself on him. The family should not plead. The family should not try to tell your story. When your man is better, a doctor might suggest a visit from you. You know, today's day and age, with the way the medical establishment is trying to intervene in addictive illness, it's much more rare for doctors to refer their patients to you. I do have a family doctor, though, that knows enough about me to know when somebody's trying to work him for drugs or somebody's drinking themselves to death, guess who he calls? And he actually talks to the family of these individuals and says, you need to call this guy Chris. So some doctors are still doing this. Some doctors are still understand that they're perhaps not, you know, well equipped to deal with the alcoholic and the drug addict. Some doctors understand that. Some doctors, because they're reading the DSM and the PDRs, are thinking, well, I think I'll just prescribe this, and that might help the problem, because they've read some article that says you should prescribe this for this. Usually, if a doctor has a lot of experience with drug addicts or alcoholics, they're going to understand that they're perhaps not well equipped to handle the whole situation to bring about a recovery. What do we need to do? What do we need to do? We need to have that talk with our family doctor. We need to have that talk. That's what I did. I sat down one day and I said, Doc, you know, here's my deal. Here's what I do. I do this as an avocation. I help a lot of people. I'm going to give you my card. I'm going to give you my phone number. I want you to use it. When you get in a situation where you're having difficulty with somebody and you think they want to get better or think they might want to get better, I want you to call me if you feel it's appropriate. I want you to call me, and I will spend time with that family or that person helping, because that's what I do. I do this as an avocation, and I am available. And I think we need to do that. One of the gravest errors in Alcoholics Anonymous today is to actually believe that anonymity means secrecy. Mm-hmm. That is so wrong. Do we break our anonymity with a picture or a last name in press, radio, TV, or film? Absolutely not. Do we speak for Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole? Absolutely not. Do we stick our head in the sand and not let people know that we're recovered alcoholics? We better not. We better be shouting that from the rooftops, because sometimes we're the only people that can help. We're the only people. We need to do this with tact and common sense. You don't go to the president of your company on your first day and say, "Hey, I'm an alcoholic. If you got any other alcoholics, I'd love to talk to him." I mean, you know, that's what this book would call leading with the chin. But what I do and what I've done for the last 15 years is talk to the human resource department. They're usually they're progressive enough to understand what recovery is. They deal with addiction in the human resource department. And I tell them how much time I have, and I tell them that, you know, I'm available to help people. And I make myself available that way. When you do that, you're alerting the human resource department that you are in a protected class of recovered a diseased person. You're in a protected class, and you can't be fired for it. Unless you happen to get caught drunk at work, they're not going to fire you for being a recovered alcoholic. You're in a protected class. So I do that. I do that with the human resource department. I do it with my own family doctor. See your man alone if possible, middle of 91. This does not mean go on a 12-step call by yourself. I've had a few problems on 12-step calls. Twice I've had my life threatened. I remember this one time, I'm on this 12-step call. This guy calls me up in the middle of the night. His name is Andy. Okay, this is like 1990. I'm brand new. Calls me up, goes, Chris. I'm like, Andy, it's 2 a.m. He goes, I know, I gotta talk to you. I'm like, well, what's going on? He goes, Satan is talking to me. And I'm like, you know, I knew enough about Satan communicating with you to ask this next question. And the next question was, how much coke did you do, Andy? You know? And he's like 3 grams, man. And I'm like, okay, we'll be over. You know, I call up somebody, and you know, we go over to get him. Now, Andy is this guy. He's like a weightlifter boxer. I'm telling you, he's like 300 pounds. He looks like Hulk Hogan. He's like this giant guy. And we go over there and we get him. I knew enough to go with somebody, right? But we put him in the back seat, and we're driving to this, we're driving to this place called Honesty House. We're gonna hand them off to Charlie. Okay? At Honesty House. Now we're driving, and so I'm driving, and I'm looking at him in the mirror like this, and I go, how you doing, Andy? He goes, is Satan still talking to me? And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, yeah, he's telling me to kill people. And I'm like, okay. And he goes, yeah, especially people that are trying to help me. I'm like, oh, okay. Made for a nervous ride to Honesty House, I gotta tell you. Oh, man. Oh, this poor guy, what happened was he wouldn't go into Honesty House because the weight set didn't have enough weights. It only went up to like 200 pounds or something, you know. So he couldn't go to this treatment center. And so the guy running Honesty House said, this guy's a wing nut. I'm sending him to Marlboro. So Marlboro is a psychiatric institute. So he went to the psychiatric institute and came back 9 months later walking like this. You know, like drugged up out of his mind, this poor guy. Another time, I'm down in North Carolina, and I've got a house down in North Carolina, and we would go down there for Thanksgiving every year. And I had an old meeting book that I've had since like 1991. And I grabbed the meeting book, and I said, okay, we're going to go over to the clubhouse. And I drive over to the clubhouse, and the clubhouse isn't there anymore. I have an old meeting book. I don't know. But somebody drives up and he's looking for the same clubhouse. He's got an old meeting book too. So I go, listen, you know, it's the two of us. I don't know where the hell the clubhouse is. Why don't we just go to Denny's and sit down and talk? This guy was right out of prison for his 13th DUI. You know, talk about it. It takes us a while to learn our lesson.
Did he drive up?
Can you imagine? His codependent girlfriend drove him up. Oh, she was she was wonderful. She was so codependent. She was like, yeah, he got his 13th DUI. He's done time in prison. I'm like, oh my God. Oh my God. She's like feeding like a vampire on this guy's dysfunction. I'm like, I never seen anything like it in my life. I'm like, whoa. You know. Oh, man. So we go to Denny's. And I do what this book says. I start to talk to him about a first step. I start to tell him, you know, about how much trouble you're in. You know, you've got an illness, alcoholism, and it's progressively fatal. You know, this is put in remission. You know, you're going to die an alcoholic death. And, rah, 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 rah. And he goes, whoa. Hold it. I go, okay. He goes, I usually kill people that give me bad news. And he's just out of prison for his 13th DUI, so I do what anybody would do. Waitress, check. You know what I mean? Have a good one, you know? And stay with her, you know? You're going to have fun. Oh, my God. I've been in situations that are pretty risky. We got to put ourselves on the firing line, folks. It's called the firing line. You know, we got to go out there and we got to get serious. We got to get serious about this stuff. Carrie and Adam, oh my God, for like the last 15 years, they've filled their house up with maniacs. You know, I mean, working with people that I don't think anybody else would work with, taking them through the steps. I've never seen any two people do more serious 12-step work than these two. So I'm gonna pass it over to Carrie.
Cool. Yeah, I love Chris's 12-step stories. Mine are like usually the guy who said like I kill people, give me bad news. I'd be like, so. You know, but that's just me. I don't scare all that easily. I got a couple things. And again, you know, this chapter is awesome. You know, in terms of and like I said, it's fairly simple. You know. In terms of how we do our first approach, and Chris is really right in terms of, you know, this was written for when we're like grabbing people out of the Bowery, we're grabbing people out of hospitals, there aren't treatment centers, there aren't these things. Most of the people I sponsor, the people I work with, I get from meetings. I do also, like, we're notorious in our area for being 12-step people. We're notorious wherever we live. People knock on our door, people we don't even know. I'll give a couple examples. We had a Wednesday night big book study out of our house in Harrison, New Jersey, which eventually became the Market Street Missions big book study. It was called The Last House on the Block. So we had this meeting out of our house forever, and it would be like all these young people were on fire with the big book. We'd be going out to treatment centers, going out to things, doing commitments, invading groups. We'd come in mass. If you were like an open, disgusting meeting, like we'd come in a mass and sit around the room and pepper it. Every other person would be talking about the steps in recovery so the meeting couldn't turn into, you know, muck. So we did this, and what happened is throughout Essex and Hudson County, all of a sudden, like people like were like, there's an AA meeting in a house somewhere on Cross Street in Harrison. Yep. So they would go look and they'd be like, okay, there's all those people smoking out in front of that brownstone. That must be it. And so people would like wandering off the street and be like, is this where the AA meeting is? And I was like, I guess, come on in. So, like, I'd be, like, bringing my kids to school. I was bringing my son. He was in first grade. And, like, one of the women I had 12-stepped, like, saw me across the playground and yells at me, Dyfus gave me my kids back because I haven't smoked crack in 3 months. And I'm like, my son's teacher's like, I'm like, how's it going? I don't really have anonymity, quite obviously. I'm not allowed to have it. And this is something, this happened this week. This is no lie. So I'm an administrator at an IOP, which means I don't really shrink heads. What I do is I run the facility where they can do that. And I help to promote an environment in which recovery happens. So I don't have a whole lot of therapeutic interaction with the exception of the intake. So I get to do, I get to do this whole, like, you know, the assessment part of and the thing, you know, every day at work as well as at home, which is really neat. So it hones my skills. But anyway, there's an assessment that comes in. This guy comes in the office and he meets with my boss, the clinical director, and the clinical director comes out and he comes out and this guy comes in, he's in the lobby and he runs into me in the lobby and he goes to me and goes, I know you. And he says this in front of my boss. And he goes, I know you. My, your husband sponsored me. You're from that meeting in Bernardsville. You're Gary. And my boss is like, he just broke your anonymity. Does that bother you? And I'm like, no. I was like, I work at a treatment center. That's going to happen. And he's like, do people do that to you in the street? I'm like, uh-huh. He's like in the supermarket? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, that doesn't bother you? Because he's not an alcoholic, so he has no idea. And I'm like, yeah, it doesn't bother me. I don't have anonymity. You know, I just don't. You know, my community knows who I am. The people around me know who I am. My name is out there. I get those phone calls. I get those, please fix them. What I love, and this is my favorite 12-step call ever, is like when whatever crazy person my husband is sponsoring finds some whacked out, traumatized, damaged, you know, brandy-soaked, you know, beautiful princess of a lady. And he decides that he is madly in love with her. The only thing that he needs to do for her is to fix her. And by doing that, what he does is says, well, you need to be sponsored by my husband's wife. Carrie, can you please fix her for me? Because I want to marry her and breed. That's always fun. I love those 12-step calls. It's like, by the way, it's like, fix her for me so I can, you know, take her hostage, you know. But, you know, and so, you know, there is a lot of, it is fun. Like, look, if you're not having fun doing this stuff, you're doing it wrong. I mean, alcoholics, we're crazy. I mean, we say insane things. We do insane things. I mean, yeah, you know, it's dangerous and your house gets broken. It's funny, is like, it does. I mean, like, I don't have a wedding ring or an engagement ring anymore. I'm not sure if it was my junkie nephew or the guy that was the heroin addict that we were detoxing on our couch. But the whole my yellow gold disappeared one day. Like, I went to go, like, put it on. I'm like, wow, only the platinum gold is here because it looks like it's silver. I was like, note to self, I shouldn't buy yellow gold anymore, so nobody's But yeah, so I mean, this stuff happens, like, and you know, I just take it at stride. Sometimes I'm like, well, you know, that kind of sucks. I did have that ring for, like, you know, 20 years, but whatever, you know, like, really, would I give up, you know, all of the experience with God that I've had carrying this message for a piece of gold? No. You know, and then and so the question is why do we do this? Okay, you know, so like drunks threaten to kill us. you know, they break our shit, they steal our stuff, they're crazy, they lie to us. You know, they do all of these things. Like, why do we do this? Why do I answer that phone at 2 o'clock in the morning with a woman who really wants to stop drinking but is unwilling to go to the hospital to detox? You know, why do I answer that phone call for the 37,000th time? Well, because there's something about sitting with another human being and watching them heal. There's something about watching the God reawaken in their, and you know, it's like, alcoholism is like this black, dense fog that just settles within us. You know, and that the deep and that dark, you ever meet somebody, like when you talk to them, you just feel like they sucked a piece of your soul. Like those spiritual vampires. You know, and alcoholics, we're spiritual vampires. We just are. You know, we don't mean to be. It's not an intentional thing, but we're vacant, you know, without alcohol and without God, and we suck the energy out of other people. We don't mean to do it. You know, it just happens. You know, and so when I'm sitting with an alcoholic and I'm sitting with them and we're talking about God and we're talking about alcoholism, we're talking about that there is hope for you. First, I have to, you know, present them with the information to make them hopeless if they're not already. And then I have to present them with the hope and I have to share my experience and I have to say, well, I was just like you and this is where I'm at now. And this is this person and this is that person and this is what we're doing and this is what it looks like. And I trick them. I have no problem tricking somebody through the 12 steps. They meet me at a meeting and I share and I'm like all fuzzy and then funny and I say funny things and they think I'm really amusing and they're like, I really want you to sponsor me. I'm like, good, meet me for a cup of coffee. Really? That's it? Yeah. Just do me this favor. Bring your big book and meet me for a cup of coffee. Because when I share in a meeting, I share solution. I just do. So I figure if you're walking up to me, whether you know it or not, God told you something. So I'm like, just come over to my house for a cup of coffee. That's all you want me to do? Yeah, yeah. Do I need to call you every day? Nope. Just come, you know, when's the next free day? This day? Okay, good. Show up at my house. Here's my directions. And we sit down, we start having a cup of coffee. Says, I want you to tell me where you're at. You know, okay, you know, I got, you know, whatever. Sometimes I got 90 days. Sometimes I got 2 years and I'm stark raving mad. Whatever it is. You know, and I just get them to start talking about their lives. And they start talking about their lives. And I use this when it talks about about getting to know the person. And it says, you know, to talk to their wife and stuff like that. Well, I find that an alcoholic is very happy to tell you all about themselves if you're willing to listen. They always want an audience. So I start allowing them to just set bear traps. They set the trap, man. They start telling me stuff. And then at first, everything's great and their life is great and everything's great. They just really like me because I'm like really cool. And I'm like, dude, I am not a cool kid. Like, you know, you don't like me. You have no idea why you're here. You have no idea why you showed up. You have no idea why it is that you felt compelled to talk to me. God is working through you. Just let this happen. Just get out of the way. Right? So we're having this conversation. Everything's great. Everything's great. Everything's great. Everything's great. But you know, yeah, my husband's been sleeping on the couch for the past 6 months. Really? Yeah, and I've been like texting my ex-boyfriend. And you know, last week he sent me a picture of his penis. And you know, and I have this habit. Like I tend to I throw up after I eat. And you know, and all of a sudden I start having this conversation with people. And all of a sudden, like, you know, they're setting the bear traps for themselves. They're telling, they just start talking and they're telling me all about the dysfunction and the unmanageability in their lives and this, that, and the other thing. And I start asking them, well, you know, have you ever worked the steps? Well, you know, I thought about, you know, step four. I know what I might do when I do it. Really? You never did a four step. Yeah, well, you know, I got the NA guide, but I'm like, but didn't I meet you in an AA meeting? Isn't that a whole nother fellowship? I just figured but it was really long. And then so I started having this, and I was like, well, you know, let me tell you a little bit about myself. And I was like, well, let me tell you about some of the dumb things I've done. I'm going to tell you about what Carrie looks like when she's drinking. And let me tell you about what Carrie looks like when she's in untreated alcoholism. I just start sharing. We're swapping stories. We're like, oh yeah, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I did this and blah, 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 blah. And I, you know, and blah, blah. And all of a sudden, I'm like, well, you know, I don't do that stuff anymore. Really? How long has it been since you did something like that? 16, 17 years. Really? You don't think about a drink? No. Never? No. You handle, like, one of the things that I did professionally for a really long time is I was a program manager for a co-occurring disorder treatment residential facility, which meant that I had to deal in barbiturates and benzos every day. I had to count them out. That was kind of part of what my job was, to do med counts. So, like, it was kind of like Scarface, where I have piles of Xanax and Valium and all kinds of, like, seriously, they all piled up on my desk, and I'm going, one, two, three, not kidding. They're in pop out, but you get my point. So I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict, I'm recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. I'm like, you know, I just had a pile of Valium on my desk the other day. I counted it out and put it away. Never thought about it. What? I'm like, and then we start talking, and all of the bear traps that they set for themselves as they start telling me all about the things going on in their lives, I'm one by one, yeah, that doesn't happen to me anymore. This is what I did about it. And by the end of the conversation, I've already ascertained whether or not they're an alcoholic. I've already helped them discover whether or not they are an alcoholic. And I haven't even cracked the book. Because there's something that's really important, and I'm going to finish up this little section on this, is a friend of mine, Mike, asked me a really long time ago. He said, can you 12-step if you never, ever, ever, if all the big books in the world disappeared, could you still carry a message with depth and weight? My answer at that time was no. Because I needed the book to tell me where the right paragraphs and passages were. Now, the experience of the 12 steps, because at that point, the 12 steps are still an intellectual exercise, and it was still about page 52, paragraph 1. You know what I mean? it was still an intellectual thing. Today, every single thing that is in this book has been incorporated into my spirit. You know, people say, well, how can you quote those pages? How do those paragraphs just fall out of your mouth? Because I read them every freaking day. I'm sitting down reading this big book. I'm leaving here today, driving home after picking up my kids and meeting with somebody to help them today at 6 o'clock. I heard a fifth step last night. I do what I say and I say what I do. If I'm telling you I'm in the 12th step, I'm in the 12th step and I mean it. And I'm willing to give up my time and energy to do this because that's what this is about. So if it means driving home from Queens and sitting down and working with another alcoholic, that's what I do. You know, I don't watch TV. My legs haven't been shaved in 3 days. My nails aren't painted. My hair is not highlighted. And I give every moment of my waking time, if I am not with my family and I'm not at my job, carrying a message and so helping to be a tool for God to help sober up drunks, because that is my personal responsibility to Alcoholics Anonymous. But with that, we'll take a 15-minute break.